Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo and Ashley Thompson. Later, we bring you the American history series, Making of a Nation. But first, this report with help from Alice Bryant.
The rising cost of attending a college or university in the United States has been an issue of much concern and debate in recent years. But what often does not get discussed is the hidden costs related to higher education, says Michael Hansen. He is Chief Executive Officer of Cengage Learning, a publisher of textbooks and developer of other learning materials. Hansen notes that the hidden costs are not immediately included in the cost of a student's tuition. Such costs include student housing and health care, and even textbooks. And he admits these costs are not small. The College Board is a nonprofit organization that researches and supports American higher education. In 2018, it found that the average yearly cost of books and supplies for a student at a public four-year college in his or her home state was $1,240. For years, higher education textbook publishers have tried to find ways of reducing their costs to students, says Hansen. Some have developed programs that permit students to temporarily own textbooks and then return them once they are no longer needed. And many schools buy textbooks back from students and offer them to other students at a reduced price. Yet Hansen says such efforts do not do much to solve the problem of rising costs. That is why, he says, his company launched a new product called Cengage Unlimited a little over a year ago.
Cengage Unlimited lets students make use of all of the textbooks the company publishes, but in digital form instead of physical copies. Cengage Unlimited offers this service to students for about $120 each study term or $180 a year. Hansen says that the service offers more than just textbooks. The digital products include videos and computer software programs that test students' understanding of what they are reading. In the past, publishing companies often would wait about 3 years before releasing popular textbooks with more up-to-date information, Hansen says. But with Cengage Unlimited, the book's authors can make changes to the digital versions at any given time. Hansen says that within 2 months of Cengage Unlimited being offered last August, 500,000 students have signed up for the service.
In the United States, Cengage is not the only publisher to move in this direction. Studies have shown that, in large part because of cost, up to 64% of college students choose not to buy the required textbooks for their classes. So, in 2014, Pearson, another educational publisher, launched its digital direct access model, which offers digital textbooks to students and teaching materials to professors. Macmillan Learning has a similar service called Launchpad. Brian Murphy notes that publishing houses that offer such services are helping themselves just as much as they are helping students. Murphy has worked in higher education textbook sales for over 30 years for companies including Pearson and his own Brian Murphy Group. He notes that publishers save a lot of money by not making physical copies of books. Also, with physical books, companies really only make money when a book is first sold. Since digital materials cannot be resold, every student who is using them has to pay the company. Yet Murphy warns that as more publishers move towards digital models, they must be mindful of how they do so. Some digital textbooks he has seen have simply been electronic versions of physical textbooks. Most students like carrying books they can take notes in, and simple digital materials do not offer anything extra to make them more desirable.
Murphy says that if publishers want their digital products to be successful, they must design the user experience to be as interactive as possible. He adds that another barrier to the success of digital textbook services is college faculty. Since publishers digitally offer all of their publications at once, they want colleges and universities to make use of all of the materials they offer. Many companies are attempting to set up partnerships with schools so that the cost for using their digital services would be included in the price of tuition. Then schools could choose to replace all traditional textbooks they sell with these products. But this often means that school administrators are deciding what materials professors must use in their classes. If professors are not satisfied with the quality of the digital content, they will likely ask students to buy other traditional textbooks, reducing the effect of cost-saving efforts, he noted. Textbook authors have their own concerns about the move to digital. Michael Spinella is the head of the Textbook and Academic Authors Association. He says that many publishers are asking authors to do more in addition to producing the content and know more about new teaching methods, all without increases in pay. It is still not clear how successful these new materials will be in replacing traditional ones, he says. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. February 14th is Valentine's Day, a day to celebrate love, romance, and relationships. But today, we will talk about some of the most overused romantic sayings in the English language. Throughout the years, people have used them way too much, so they have come to mean almost nothing. They have become clichés. We will start with one that breaks the laws of physics. Love makes the world go round.
You know love makes the world go round.
Love, of course, does not make the earth go around. Just ask a scientist. The expression, love makes the world go round, has nothing to do with the planet spinning. It means love is so important that without it, life would be sad and not worth living. Please don't get me wrong. It is a lovely thought, but to be honest, very overused. Another cliche is the expression, love means never having to say you're sorry. Of all the romantic sayings, this is probably the one that people make fun of the most. How could you not? Apologizing to someone you love is important. As children, it is one of the first rules we learn. If I do something wrong or hurt someone else, I should say, "I'm sorry." This expression comes from the 1970 movie Love Story. A young man is rich, while his love interest is poor. The rich man's father wants to keep the two apart. So you know the story is not going to end well. To make matters worse, the young woman is dying. But they get married anyway. So when he does something hurtful and apologizes, she says this now famous and often parodied sentence.
"Jenny, I'm sorry.
Don't. Love means never having to say you're sorry."
Writing on the website Psychology Today, psychologist Barbara Rose explains the expression and defends it. She writes that if you really love someone without conditions, or as we say, unconditionally, you will forgive them of everything. So there's no need to apologize. Well, that may sound good on paper, but I still want an apology if someone I love does something bad to me. A mother loves her child unconditionally, but she still deserves an apology if that child lies to her or says something mean. Love hurts. Anyone who has experienced unrequited or unreturned love knows that it can hurt like nothing else. To love someone who does not love you back can be difficult, even painful. Saying love hurts to a friend in great pain from a broken heart does nothing. It is an empty statement that has been said a million times before. You would be better off not saying anything than saying this cliche. And that's our Valentine's program on words and their stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
A new museum in the American state of Wisconsin may hold the largest collection of bobbleheads anyone has ever seen. Bobbleheads are small figures with abnormally large heads. The heads, which are on springs, move up and down. The figures are usually made to look like famous people, from sports champions to actors to politicians. The National Bobblehead Hall of Fame and Museum recently opened in the city of Milwaukee. Phil Sklar and Brad Novak started collecting bobbleheads 16 years ago. Then, 4 years ago, the two friends decided to do something with their collection. They quit their jobs, began making their own bobbleheads to earn money, and searched for bobbleheads at second-hand shops. Then they decided on a physical place for a museum. The two have more than 10,000 bobbleheads. The museum has room to show about 6,500 at one time. They have figures that look like characters from the movies Star Wars and The Wizard of Oz. They have the first ever football and baseball bobbleheads from the early 1960s. They even have a life-sized bobblehead in their collection. And then there are the political bobbleheads. One looks like American President Donald Trump from his days as a television star on The Apprentice. The figure says, "You're fired," with the push of a button. Sklar and Novak are in the process of having their collection recognized as the world's largest by the Guinness Book of World Records. The current record is 2,396, held by Phil Darling. The 40-year-old Canadian has gotten 500 more bobbleheads since that official count in 2015, he says. Darling says he will be a bit sad not to hold the record anymore. But he says he hopes to one day make it to Milwaukee to see the collection and meet Sklar and Novak. "It's on my bucket list," Darling said. Sklar said he hopes the museum will appeal to bobblehead fans as well as people looking for something fun to do. Along with the collection itself, the museum also explains how bobbleheads are made and introduces the real people who the bobbleheads represent. Sklar added, "There are so many negative things going on. We need more places to escape and have a good time, and also educate at the same time. So hopefully we will be an asset to the community." I'm Ashley Thompson.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In July of 1861, Union soldiers from the North and Confederate soldiers from the South fought the first major battle in the American Civil War. They clashed at Manassas, or Bull Run, Virginia, less than 50 kilometers from Washington. The Union soldiers fought fiercely, but two large Confederate forces broke the Union attack. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell about some of the other early battles of the Civil War.
Northerners had expected to win the Battle of Bull Run. They believed the Confederacy would fall if the Union won a big military victory early in the war. Now, however, there was great fear that Southern soldiers would seize Washington. The Union needed to build and train an army quickly. President Abraham Lincoln named General George McClellan to do this. McClellan was 34 years old. The young general had two important tasks. He must defend Washington from attack, and he must build an army to strike at enemy forces in Virginia. McClellan wasted no time. He put thousands of troops into position around the city, and he built 48 forts. After this rush of activity, however, little more happened for a long time. McClellan told his wife, "I shall take my own time to make an army that will be sure of success. As soon as I feel my army is well organized and well trained and strong enough, I will force the rebels to a battle." McClellan kept making excuses for why he would not move against the enemy. His excuses became a continuing source of trouble for President Lincoln. The public, the press, and politicians all demanded that McClellan do something. They wanted to win the war, and win it right away.
McClellan commanded the biggest army in the Union, the Army of the Potomac. But it was not the only army. Others were battling Confederate forces in the West. The Confederates had moved up through Tennessee into the border state of Kentucky, They built forts and other defensive positions across the southern part of the state. They also blocked as many railroads and rivers as they could. Their job was to keep Union forces from invading the South through Kentucky. One of the Union generals in the area was Ulysses Grant. Grant had served in the Army for 20 years. He had fought in America's war against Mexico and had won honors for his bravery. When that war ended, he was sent to an Army base far from his wife and children. He did not like being without them, and he did not like being an officer in peacetime. Grant began to drink too much alcohol. He began to be a problem. In 1854, he was asked to leave the Army. When the Civil War started, Grant organized a group of unpaid soldiers in Illinois. With the help of a member of Congress, he was named a general. All of the other Union generals knew Ulysses Grant. Few had any faith in his abilities. They were sure he would always fail.
Grant, however, had faith in himself and his men. He believed he could force Confederate soldiers to withdraw from both Kentucky and Tennessee. Then he would be free to march directly into the Deep South, Mississippi. Two Confederate forts stood in Grant's way. They were in Tennessee, close to the Kentucky border. United States Navy gunboats captured the first, Fort Henry, on the Tennessee River. That fort was easy to attack and not well defended. The fighting was over by the time Grant and his men got there. The second, Fort Donelson, was nearby on the Cumberland River. It was stronger and defended by 20,000 soldiers. Grant surrounded the fort and let the Navy gunboats shell it. The fighting there lasted several days.
At one point, the Confederates tried to break out of the fort and escape. They opened a hole in the Union line and began to retreat. Suddenly, however, their commanding officer decided it would be wrong to retreat. He ordered them back to the fort. After that, there was no choice. The Confederates would have to surrender. The commanding officer sent a message to General Grant. What were the terms of surrender? Grant's answer was simple. No terms except unconditional and immediate surrender. The Confederates gave up Fort Donelson. Grant took 14,000 prisoners. It was the greatest Union victory since the start of the war. Ulysses Grant was a hero. Newspapers called him Unconditional Surrender Grant.
After the Union victory at Fort Donelson, Confederate forces withdrew from Tennessee. They moved farther south and began to regroup at Corinth, Mississippi. Confederate generals hoped to build one big army to stop Ulysses Grant. They would have to move fast. Grant was marching toward Corinth with 40,000 men. Another 35,000, under the command of Don Buell, were to meet him on the way. Grant arrived in the area first. He waited for Buell, 30 kilometers from Corinth, near a small country meeting hall called Shiloh Church. Confederate General Albert Sidney Johnston was waiting too. He had more than 40,000 men, about the same as Grant, and he was expecting another 20,000. But when he learned that Grant was nearby, he decided not to wait. He would attack immediately.
Johnston did not know it, but his attack came as a surprise to the Union Army. Union officers had refused to believe reports that Johnston was on the move. They said his army was not strong enough to attack. Union troops did not prepare defensive positions. They had no protection when the battle began. The fighting at Shiloh was the bitterest of the war. It was not one battle, but many. Groups of men fought each other all across the wide battlefield. From a distance, they shot at each other. Close up, they cut each other with knives. The earth became red with blood. The dead and wounded soon lay everywhere. At first, the Confederates pushed Grant's army back. They had only to break through one more line, and victory would be theirs. But in the thick of the struggle, General Johnston was shot in the leg. The bullet cut through an artery. Johnston bled to death before help arrived. Any hope for a Southern victory at Shiloh died with him. By the time the fighting began again the next day, General Buell had arrived to help Grant. The Confederate Army retreated. The Union Army let it go.
Shiloh, the word itself, came to mean death and destruction. The Battle of Shiloh had brought home to the American people, both of the North and South, the horror of war. It was the first time so many men, 100,000, had fought against each other in the Western world. It was the American people's first real taste of the bloodiness of modern warfare. As one soldier who fought there said, it was too shocking, too horrible. I hope to God that I may never see such things again. The North won the Battle of Shiloh, but it paid a very high price for victory. More than 13,000 Union soldiers were killed, wounded, or missing. On the Confederate side, more than 10,000 soldiers were killed or wounded. The North celebrated the news of its victory, but joy quickly turned to anger when the public learned of the heavy losses. People blamed General Grant. They demanded that President Lincoln dismiss him. Lincoln thought of the two men who were now his top military commanders, McClellan and Grant. They were so different. McClellan organized an army and then did nothing. Grant organized an army and moved. Lincoln said of Grant, "I cannot do without this man. He fights."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.